Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
I'm feeling like a troubled soul.
Really?
Not really, no. But I thought about troubled souls a lot because today's guest is not a troubled soul himself.
That's all you know.
But he is a very passionate person.
Yeah.
And actually, I felt a kind of... what's the word?
Affinity.
Can you say, yeah, affinity or kinship or something with him because of his passion, because he has been described as a polymath because he's obviously very knowledgeable about numerous things, as well as being very talented. He's an actor and very funny man, but also multidisciplinary, amazing script writer.
Yeah.
But
you may come again.
Thank you. But I connected with him because he made this incredible documentary about John Minton, who was an artist that I knew nothing about.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people knew about him.
And John Minton was a troubled soul. And there are elements of John Minton's life story that I also connect with because he was gay and there's a whole kind of...
You're not gay, are you?
Am I? Yeah, so I'm really thrilled to meet our guest today. And I was really thinking about this whole idea of being like a super fan and somehow that you can... be educated and you can have all those things, but actually some of the things that change your life are personal passions.
Right.
And I remember being a teenager myself and really connecting to the life story of Frida Kahlo, which I've spoken about before. Mm-hmm. And for our guest, I think John Minton had a very similar effect. So I'm looking forward to meeting our guest today.
Great.
We would like to welcome Mark Gatiss.
Hello.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Very good.
Good.
Not so troubled today.
Not so troubled today.
Good
except
news.
By the world situation.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh my God. Horrific.
This
horrific.
Is going out post-apocalypse.
Yeah. This is.
Into
yeah, it's
a
just
sort
us
of
here.
Grey wilderness.
We no, don't realise it's just us cockroaches that are remaining.
But they're good listeners. Bums on seats. It doesn't matter.
I'm not sure they're there anymore either.
No,
I don't think anything's there.
Don't. So, but anyway, but we were just talking about troubled souls and we touched on John Minton, and this is an artist which you felt very strongly connected to because you saw a self-portrait of his in the National Gallery when you were a teenager, right?
Mm. Yes. I mean, it's one of those moments, you know. I was on a trip, a trip to London and National Portrait Gallery, and I saw this picture.
Mm.
And I just immediately sort of fell for it. I mean, not in the sort of silly way. It's like I knew he was dead. But there was something so sad about it. These huge sort of plaintive brown eyes and this sort of sad clown face.
Yeah.
Someone once said he had a face like a Renaissance saint that had been left too... a wax Renaissance saint that had been left too close to the fire.
Got it.
And I love
quite saggy, wasn't it? In sort of hot, sallow.
Curious, yes. Yeah. It's a clown's face, really. It's a sad clown's face. And I loved the style, sort of slightly scratchy style. And what I then discovered really was a sort of mid-century style, which is still really pretty unfashionable. And I fell for the style.
Mm.
And a lot of those people around him, Keith Vaughan and the Roberts and that sort of Soho circle.
Mm.
And then very rapidly afterwards, I saw the Lucian Freud portrait of Minton, which is astonishing.
Yeah.
Which is like a sort of death.
Is that's not in the National Portrait Gallery as well, is it?
I don't know where that is. No, it was in the Minton Centenary a couple of years ago in Chichester, but I don't know where it's actually housed. But Minton asked Freud to paint him, and it is a sort of statement.
It's like, a total. It's quite a devastating painting.
He commissioned him, didn't he?
Yeah.
So would he have paid him to do it?
Yeah, I think so.
So what sort of money would that have been?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they were sort of frenemies.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff's just come out since Freud's death. A lot of books, and I was reading one the other day, and there's a rather depressing little moment when I think he's in his studio and someone sort of says, oh, Johnny Minson's killed himself, and Freud just kind of goes, and it's not
just shrugs it off.
Doesn't reflect, that was on radio, I forgot. It doesn't reflect very well on him, but there was a point where he was sort of leading the pack, and then he absolutely fell.
It felt like, there's lots of stories in there. We come on to that, but I just want to go back to you and how you got into visiting gallery spaces and everything. And so was this one of the first times you were in a gallery space?
Well, as I remember, it's a bit blurry, like these things are, my first sort of few trips to London. But I always loved art. I always drew. And
from like what age? Like?
Oh, like 4 or 5.
Right.
You know.
And where did you grow up?
County Durham, in the northeast. Mm-hmm. And I was, very encouraged, I have to say. My art teachers were great. And I always loved, looking at paintings, particularly. I've always loved religious paintings.
Oh, right.
And I've always sort of been hungry to know more about various painters, you know. So I would.
Do you think that's a gay thing? A lot of people said they look at Christ on the cross because he's this naked man with a loincloth around his bits. And a lot of gay people have found that that's their first kind of connection with the naked male.
There's quite a few famous women who talk about that as well. Mm, so really? I think it's just a...
Well, there's two things going on. One is that a lot of those altarpieces and things were explicitly commissioned to provide exactly that
for thing. Titillation.
Really? Yes,
definitely.
No.
Yes. There's a reason why there is so much homoeroticism in those, in those sorts of pictures. It's the only... It's like, I'd like you to do a Saint Sebastian, please. Oh, would you?
And Saint Sebastian is the guy who got the arrows through him, but he's always this beautiful young man with golden, like curly hair, and he's topless.
And you can sort of tell the ones which are sort of for general church, and things that might have been for private introspective.
Oh my God!
It's a real thing, a very, very real thing. And there are occasions, if you can find them, which are absolutely fantastic, where there are reverse pictures which are much more explicit.
Saucier.
Yeah, for private contemplation. But I think there's that, and then in a sort of modern context, as you say, it's like, for me, all I had was the underwear section of the Brian Mills catalogue, or Jesus. So I'm sure there was a lot of that going on, but you're sort of drawn to those things. And then I was also very into Aubrey Beardsley.
Who's that?
Oh, wow.
He was, a genius illustrator. He died when he was 25.
British?
Yeah, right. And he was the master of pen and ink. It's incredible. In fact, I'm making a documentary about him at the moment.
Oh, great.
And he and Minton, I think, were the sort of twin...
He was a gay guy, though.
He wasn't gay.
Oh.
He was other. It's a long... I'll come on to him because it's very interesting.
Oh, right. The original non-binary, was he?
Sort of. But, wow. And he was so ill. He had consumption and died of it at 25. He was sort of virtually bedridden. And his life was lived through his pictures, which are extraordinarily erotic. I mean, almost in your face doesn't come into it, because I'll describe this later.
Yeah.
But somewhere in that sort of admixture of being a teenage gay and wanting to find a life and something to sort of project yourself onto your own experience, which I think everybody does, then with paintings and with artists, you sort of think, Frida Kahlo, whatever you go.
Yeah.
Who are you? I want to know, what was your life? Why is it? Is it like mine? Can I be like you in some way?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that going on, and therefore I sort of read up a lot on the history of art and tried to go to a lot of galleries whenever I could.
Did you want to be an artist?
Not really. I mean, I at school I always loved drawing, and I struggled with painting. I think, I don't know what we actually painted with. It can't have been much.
Crayons.
Crayons. Can't be much stuff of poster paint.
Glitter.
It was glowy.
Probably acrylic paint.
I did this amazing glowy picture. I paint now, and art has become an incredible solace for me. I've sort of rediscovered everything I loved about it.
Oh, wow.
It's been an amazing thing for me.
Well, because when I was looking at, I mean, you sent me some images of artworks that you've made. I was looking up on Google.
Dick pics
of your own dick, which is astonishing. But there was images online of drawings you've done, and I found a lot of it. There's a lot of fan pics of you everywhere because you have a massive fan base. If you just put in Mark Gatiss art, there's just lots of images from all over the world, mainly South Korea. You've got a big following.
Okay, but also, that must have increased with the whole Doctor Who like connection.
Of course, and Sherlock.
Sherlock, yeah, of course. And also Game of Thrones.
And Dracula, my
God. Game of Thrones, Pedro always gets drawn. Our friend Pedro Pascal wasn't getting drawn. Yeah. And he gets so many paintings and drawings of him.
But I found drawings that you'd made. One especially you tweeted of David Tennant, which then went viral everywhere.
Yeah. A long time ago.
Which was an amazing work. And one of Les Dawson that was up for some charity auction.
Wow.
But a lot of the work that you seem to be doing is portraiture of other people. Mm. And why do you think that is? Why are you drawn to that? Is that mainly your output at the moment when you're saying you're making art yourself?
Yes, I like them the best, I think. I mean, I've done a little bit of landscape and still life, and I would like to do more. I'm just trying to get better and learn. But I've always loved people's faces. I think the reason I went and I saw Matt Minton picture all those years ago, and the reason I went to the National Portrait Gallery, which is still my favourite, is I just love looking at people's faces. And that there's a lot going on there. There's that thing, you can look at someone and see they have an extraordinarily modern face.
Yes. I always look at the paintings and it's like old Holbeins, and I'm like, oh, well, Benedict Cumberbatch could play that part, or Eddie Redmayne a bit. You can cast them because you go, wow, you look exactly the same as someone now.
Or Hogarth, particularly, who actually is Ross Kemp. It's eluded him, but he looks exactly like Ross Kemp. He really does.
In the EastEnders times or now? I mean, he hasn't
bit
changed.
Bit of both. But the EastEnders times. But there's that. And then there's also, you look at people who look strangely distant. It's like they belong to their age, you know, which I find. And then just like, you think, what's going on? There can be a very straightforward picture. John Singer Sargent is one of my absolute favourites, an absolute genius. In the end, he said, I can't paint another portrait. I'm so sick of them. He was the most incredibly famous and rich society portraitist. And for a long time, people thought that's all he was. If you look at his pictures now, they are psychologically fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he does all these rich people.
Dame Ellen Terry is the one.
Yes,
as Lady Macbeth. Shakespearean role, yes.
She, because Sargent lived on the same street as Oscar Wilde, Tite Street in Chelsea. And there's weirdly, despite the fact they were near neighbours, there's no real connection. Sargent was almost certainly gay. But there's a wonderful thing where Wilde watches Ellen Terry arrive in a cab wearing the dress.
No!
Yes, she just comes out as Lady Macbeth just to be painted. It's like, oh, I wonder what she's up to today. His pictures are, you know, there's a lot of strange stuff going on. He does all these American families and stuff, and there's an amazing one, I can't remember what it's called, but there's these three children with great big Chinese pots behind them. And on the surface, it looks like just a portrait of someone's kids. Mm. But there's something going on.
They're all troubled souls.
He finds his way into them.
And that's interesting because I heard you talk before about the early days of the League of Gentlemen, which is obviously, I think that's how you initially broke through, no?
Yeah.
As a writer of that, but also as a star of it. And those characters in League of Gentlemen were, again, like based often on real people. Mm-hmm. So you've got this kind of psychological, because it was incredibly funny, but it's also incredibly like
there's
on the point.
There's a lot of troubled souls.
Yeah. And like but it's the depth of characters are really, that's why it's so powerful. Because it's like, and it was definitely a precursor to Little Britain and all these other things that then, you know, had a platform in a way, I think, because of that show.
Mm.
But I find it so dark, that kind of human condition that is present in that work. So do you think that's also just like a passion of yours?
I suppose it's the same thing. It's sort of looking at people and their lives and finding that interesting. And you know when you come across a sort of a situation or a life that you think, well, there's something interesting going on there, or that potentially funny, but also what we always did in the League, I think, which is embrace the pair of them, as it were. I always say there's a false kind of disparity between funny and sad. That's what life is like.
Mm.
And it's like,
more
you
comedy,
know,
tragedy.
Comedy is. It's a flip of the same thing. Yeah. And everyone knows that. And yet, you know, comedies never win Best Picture Oscar.
Mm.
And a great comic performance is never as good as a great tragic one. You know what I mean? It's true.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's absolute
nonsense, because making people laugh is the hardest thing in the world, and it's what everyone wants the most. But it's always inflected with sadness. I think the best things are. It's bittersweet. There's no.
And actually, it's weirdly making me think of Jim Carrey, because Jim Carrey, like, he's got that combination of, like, real sadness in his comedy.
You think of Robin Williams.
Yeah, Robin Williams, exactly.
It's just that ability.
They're the greats,
they're the best performers. The ability to be funny and then make you cry.
I mean, there's a sort of ongoing myth about, you know, about troubled comics, that the best ones are actually, you know, like Hancock are just like suicidal.
Miserable off stage.
There's an awful lot of truth in that, but at the same, it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be that way. It is absolutely true that John Cleese stopped being as funny when he got better.
So Fawlty Towers, he was at his lowest point emotionally in his life, and it was the best comedy work ever.
Thank God he's happy now, but he's not as funny.
Oh, God.
But it doesn't have to be that way. You know? Yeah. But I think there's a measure of it. I think if you see the world in its sort of absurdity in one way, you also see its sort of squalor and its grotesqueness. But then that's part of the thing. That's part of the joy. It's a very Hogarthian thing. Yeah. I think there's an amazing celebration of life and all its excesses, but it's also terribly, you know, fleshy and sad and bleak.
Well, it seems like it's the interior which is what you're drawn to in portraits. So when you're drawing people now, do you feel like you're trying to do what you're saying John Singer Sargent was doing, or like John Minton was doing, is you're trying to get to the interior of these people?
I suppose. I mean, I'm just trying to get better. I mean, the truth.
This is a passion project for you, is it? Or is it something you'd like to have a show one day?
I might. Well, I don't know what. But I'm just trying to learn. And I find that's something I've kind of, having sort of rediscovered it. Mm. And I rather wish I'd done this 20 years ago.
So when did you rediscover it?
About 2 years ago.
Oh, I see. So really recently.
Yeah, I've always dabbled. And I've got a little room in the back of our house, which was explicitly built to paint it, and then just became a junk room.
You know? You made it. When was it? When did you build it?
That's 15 years.
And you were like, I want to use this room.
Yeah,
for one
and I did.
So
and then
it was
I'd,
always there.
I'd sort of not do anything for 6 months, and I just thought, I want to.
Oh, you didn't write in there. That was literally like, this is the painting room.
And
this is the writing
room.
And
then junk room.
right.
Then the Chinese room.
But also, I imagine you're incredibly busy, because I saw the talk you did for the Oxford Union.
Oh, yeah.
And it said you had to, like, you mentioned you had to, like, cancel it twice before because you were just so busy. And
I am.
You know, between acting and writing and all these things you're doing.
But you've got to make room for this. That's the decision I made a couple of years ago. It was like, I'm going to make room. I'm going to go to classes. Mm. Try and get better, learn about mixing paint and all the things I've sort of nearly done for years. You know, because you sort of, I've done that thing, have you do that, but you sort of start thinking, I'm not sure, but I think somehow I imagine I'm going to have another life.
Yeah.
Another parallel.
It's an estuary, isn't it? Yeah. You off.
You go, actually, no, if I really need to do this, or I'm never going to do it.
Never going to do it. Yeah, it'll just be a thought in your mind.
Where are you doing art classes then? Is this a regular thing?
I did a weekly one in Islington with my friend Aaron, and we had a great laugh. There's so much come out of that, I can't tell you, just in terms of writing.
Oh, really?
Actually meeting people.
Oh, characters.
I've got an idea for a play and all sorts of stuff.
Really?
And characters.
But that's proof you need to live your life as well.
Yes,
in order to get...
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know, often people spend like the whole of their teenage years and all your early years of forming, and then you come out with your amazing project, like your debut album or your first script or something, and then people forget they lived. And that's the reason
you've got nothing left to talk. That's so true.
Yeah.
That's what Andrew Davis always says, you know, if you want to be a writer, don't just write. You've got to do stuff.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you write about being a writer. And I think it's acting as well. You know, so much of it is informed by just your life and odd things or strange, unusual things or funny things that happen to you. Just go,
Do you stop if people are arguing on a bus? Would you stop and listen? Or if there's a row in the street, would you kind of stand in the doorway and observe? Oh,
I've never done that Alan Bennett thing of actually writing down stuff. I think I should. I sometimes put things on my phone because people do honestly
say the most
incredibly funny and odd things.
Yeah.
I sort of collect voices sometimes. There was this guy I met at a dinner party literally 15 years ago who had this, it sounded a bit like, it was like Charlton of the Wheelers. He had this extraordinary voice like that. And I couldn't get over it. I just wanted him to talk forever. I think he was in a stage management spot like that. And I held it back for years. I didn't know what to do with it. And then there was a character in the League specials we did a couple of years ago. And I thought, well, I think it's this. And then the thing is, I literally corpsed myself. I thought about it so long. All I had to say was, it was quite a big fella. It was like, I'm not going to have much. I'm going to have four or five starters. And I'd made myself laugh thinking about it so much. But when we shot it, I couldn't do it. I was crying with laughter. I was so ashamed.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
But you were able to archive that sound in your memory just by that line. That kind of like you giving yourself four or five starters, that quote, and then you was able to access that voice again.
Yeah,
that's
we'll
quite
be able to do that, don't we?
Well, and then you record it on a voice memo.
No,
you hold it in yourself.
Oh, you hold it within you.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's
cool.
That's I mean, I as an actor as well, that's sort of what I do, is that you hold on to these things in your psyche, don't you? And then you're able to just draw on them later on. It's
if you're lucky that's a sort of reservoir you can draw on.
Yeah.
A personality type, you know. There's all that sort of actory bollocks about starting with the shoes and all that sort of stuff. But the absolute truth is you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And I don't feel I'm there until I've got the voice. And then everything sorts
of mine's clicks, a rhythm thing. If I can find a rhythm for that character, then I'm like, oh, okay, I think I know what this is now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can sit in that comfortably, can't you?
Yes, and that's the thing. If you feel comfortable in yourself, I think, then you can just go off and do it without feeling like you're sort of plonking fake things on top of
you. But you can also feel it instinctively when you are doing that, can't you? When you're, yeah.
I've just started thinking about this idea of you going back to painting. And is there something for you about making art that's, because it's you in front of a canvas or in front of a page if you're about to draw something, it's so like you facing yourself somehow. And also that kind of solace to sort of go, because I guess a lot of what you do is talking to the world and connecting with lots of people. Even if you're writing it, it still then goes out and connects. So in a way, is it more personal for you to go back to that sort of place of creating painting or something?
To use a very buzzy word, it's very mindful.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's the only thing I ever do where I can forget. I am a tea addict. And as the only thing I do where I can forget I've got a cup of tea.
What sort
really?
Of tea?
Just sort of builder's tea.
Builder's, really?
But,
normal milk?
Normal milk, yeah.
Oh, right, wow.
And I turn around and go, oh, my God, it's stone cold. Because I've forgotten about it. Nothing else can keep me from tea.
That's interesting. So you kind of lose yourself in the...
lose myself. It's like it uses a different part of my head that... And it's meditative
yeah,
obviously,
it's meditative,
and
yeah.
you sort of, you know, that it's lovely thing.
You go into a trance
yeah.
then?
Yeah. You know, even when you watch kids, I love this, when you watch kids drawing and they've got their tongues out.
Yeah, concentrating.
It's that thing going on. And I think if you get into a zone where, you know, you try. This is my favourite bit is when, especially doing a portrait, is when you've got your palette is sort of fluid enough that you're going, oh, it's that colour there. And you can just sort of draw it, take it.
Wow.
And it's difficult to get into that stage. You can't sort of start cold. I often try and do a thing in one sitting because if you go back to it, you have to sort of start again. You end up just doing another layer and stuff like that. But I think that is really very sort of mindful. You kind of, you feel like you're in a zone, you know, and then you stand back and think, oh, shit, I'm going to have to start again.
Do you have natural light in your studio?
Yeah. And, but I'm going to do a bit more. I'm going to sort of try and make it a bit more professional in terms of like artificial light and cutting off light. Just sort of making the way if you're painting a still life, you sort of put it in a box.
Yes.
So you've got constant light and stuff like that.
Well, you can
and I've got more
it,
more people sitting for me now, which are light. I'm trying to do more directly from light.
Really?
Oh, really? That's interesting. Hard.
And these are paintings or are these drawings still?
Mostly paintings, yeah.
Wow.
But the and drawing is like charcoal has been a total revelation to me. And that came from doing classes. I tried charcoal years ago and I just got so messy.
Messy,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. But, it's an amazing, there's this thing called mass effect. Which you essentially mass everything in, and then you take it away with little stubs of paper and then a rubber, and it creates an amazing sort of 3D quality, like a proper head, you know. And it's been a revelation to me. I love
so for shading and shadowing.
Yeah.
It's like
absolutely amazing.
You're making me want to draw. I haven't made art since I was about 11.
Well, come on. Make?
Well, just drawings and stuff. I used to like draw my parents' garden or their car or the house and stuff. But it's really bizarre. I literally have shut off. That's why I love art so much, because I don't make it, actually.
Well, you should do it.
But you're making me think that idea of slowing down as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm so like, you know, ideas all the time.
I'd like to just make plates, throw a plate.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, we love a good ceramic, though, don't we?
We do love a ceramic, don't
we? We do, darling.
We do. So let's get back to John Minton and you at the National Portrait Gallery when you was 18 or something, younger?
Four.
It's
about 18. You were a quick.
And is that portrait still there? Is that a constant in the MPG?
It is, yes. It was. Actually, I did a photo shoot a couple of years ago and they just renovated the gallery and I had to go there out of hours and it was amazing because I always go and look at it.
But do you? Is it like there. A touchstone for you?
And it's sort of, as I remember, it's pretty much in the same place because that's my favourite part as well, the 20th century gallery. But it's the MPG is closing for 2 or 3 years, which is
frank. When?
Very soon.
I didn't know that.
For
know
renovation. And I don't know where. I think there's I think they're going to sort of move the pictures around, which is not that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So why is it 20th century artists have kind of got your goat?
Well, it's. That was a bit a discovery way back then. And I was just very drawn to. It's not the whole thing. I think I find some of them quite muddy and in a sort of slightly depressing post-war way. John Piper and Craxton, and they're incredible stuff. Mm. And Keith Vaughan, who I was always slightly obsessed with Keith Vaughan. He's another one. He used to share a studio with Minton, and he just drew obsessively male nudes. Mm. You can buy them for very little money because he did hundreds and hundreds of them. And there are.
He was gay, obviously.
Yeah.
Right?
He killed himself too in the 70s.
How old was he?
He was quite a bit older, but he. It's.
And he used to take pictures at the ponds, didn't he? And then draw people at the ponds, like men at the ponds, yeah.
But I read his diaries came out when I was about 18 and I got them out of the library. I'll never forget this. Isn't it funny? The formative touchstones, like the Brian Mills catalogue. Mm. But Keith Vaughan's diaries are one of those for me because he lived this extraordinarily Spartan existence eventually. And he had a trick towel for wiping up cum from him and his friends. And he kept it under the bed and he'd bring it out. It'd literally like, you know, when you put a towel on the line in a frost and it's just literally like, it's literally stiff as a board.
Like a poppadom.
And he's tricked out. And I remember reading that just going, wow.
Oh my God.
Is this a life I want to aspire to?
Yes.
He was into sort of autoeroticism and eventually used to connect himself to the mains.
What?
To give him sort of electric shocks.
Oh my God. Onto his bits?
Yeah.
Wow,
how would you do that without like destroying your member?
So maybe that's why he killed himself.
Oh my God, he was in like major pain.
But like I loved all that mid-century stuff, and I got very into their stories. There were these two extraordinary men, Colquhoun and McBride, the Roberts.
Yeah,
who were lovers, beautiful Scottish. Self-destructive things, and they were in Bacon and Freud's circle. And
we're talking at a time when homosexuality was desperately illegal, but within art circles, it was accepted. Everyone was like au fait with everyone being openly gay and sleeping with each other. And
it's a different. I mean, it's a sort of demimonde. You know, Soho was just something else, really, and normal rules didn't seem to apply. You know, but it's incredibly. I've always thought this, you know, it's one of those worlds. It's like, you know, being a friend of Dylan Thomas. You look at Thomas's life, but actually knowing him was really difficult. And these people, the difference between Bacon and Minton, Freud and the others, is that Bacon and Minton and Freud worked. They would get plastered and then they go home and work. Mm. The Roberts had this amazing little moment, but then they forgot to do any paintings. They just got pissed for the rest of their lives.
And was their work good?
Yes, it's very striking, particularly Colquhoun. But then they just lived off their reputation. There's a great book about them called The Last Bohemians, and there's a chapter called The Wraiths of Soho. And it's desperately sad. I mean, they just they became like ghosts, you know, and there's a lot of that about. And as Norman Bowler, who I interviewed for the documentary.
Yes, the actor.
Who, and I remember, this is another moment. You see, I knew him from Softly Softly when I was a kid, the Zedcars spin-off. And I remember first coming across Norman Bowler's name and connection to Minton, thinking, it can't be. And then there's a picture of him, and went, oh my God.
Oh, wow.
And he was an 18-year-old bodybuilder, and Minton was basically in love with him, I think. And he's a wonderful man, Norman. But
And you own one of those paintings, don't you? Or drawings?
I do, not of him. I own one of Spencer Churchill, the wrestler. Yeah. But Norman said he got out of it. He just thought, I've got, you know, he's just, you know, the scales fell from his eyes. He just looked around at the Coach and Horses one night and just thought, I've got to get out of here or it'll destroy
me. Is that the pub, the Coach and Horses? Yeah. That was the one. That's still there, isn't
it? Yeah, and all the French house.
On Greek Street.
Yeah. And then he said, about 4 or 5 years later, he was passing through Soho and he thought, I'll just pop in. And he said he popped back to the Coach and Horses and Geoffrey Bernard was halfway through the same story he was telling the night that Norman left.
Oh my God.
And he just turned on his heel and never went back.
Wow.
Geoffrey Bernard was the critic, theatre critic.
And you know, legendary drinker. And I'll show you a picture. Minton did a drawing of him when he was 17. He was the most astonishingly beautiful man.
Really? Yeah.
And then you wouldn't know it, obviously.
So Minton shared a studio with the Roberts.
Yeah.
And they were like the Gilbert and George of their time. Yeah. So they both made work. They're both integrated into the work. Yeah. They weren't separately working. They were one piece.
And there was a sort of friendly, not so friendly rivalry.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of goes for all of them. Like all those sort of circles, you know, people end up, you know, the reason that Lennon and McCartney worked so well together is because they go, oh, you've written Penny Lane, have you? I'll write Strawberry Fields.
Yeah, like
and then separately, it's not the same.
Yeah.
And I think there's an amazing point for all of them where they're just sort of bubbling over with creativity. But Minton felt detached from it. And I think ultimately people saw him as an illustrator, not a painter. And he is an amazing
illustrator.
Mm.
But eventually I think it sort of preyed on him. But he was doomed always. He said to people from quite early, I won't live past 40. I don't think he wanted to.
But he was also incredibly well known in his lifetime, wasn't he? Compared to some of the other artists who became better known later.
Yeah.
When you were talking about the price of that Freud painting, it probably would have been like 500 quid or something at the time because his paintings didn't sell for a lot until much, much later. Even when David Dawson started working with Freud, they were actually still quite affordable.
Were they?
Yeah, so it's quite amazing to think that they were all like a no.
If you had a time machine.
But it is quite crazy to think of that circle of people in Soho all being in the same room at the same time. Yeah. And like, it's totally surreal.
And not realising that they were part of it. They were changing
exactly.
art history.
Yeah, because you couldn't see
always,
it at that point.
I love that. It's the curse of the biopic. It's what I call Morning Monet. You just go, you can't believe it.
No.
But they really were all those people. You just like, God.
And I love all the stories as well. Like the one of Minton having a crush on his studio mate and like how they would like kick him out of the studio and be like, wait outside because you're too emotional.
Crying on the stairs. Yeah.
All the kind of like height of emotion of it.
Yeah.
And he was quite an extreme character, wasn't he, Minton? So he'd have like real highs where he'd like dance on the dance floor and go completely crazy.
Manic.
Yeah, manic.
Do you think he's manic depressive, bipolar?
I think so, yes. I mean, it's what we would have called manic depression.
Yeah.
Probably bipolarity now, certainly. There's only that time tiny fragment of him
that
dancing
clip.
But it's amazingly revealing because his face just falls into what we know from the pictures. Everyone you talk to, he was the life and soul, kindest man, amazingly generous, but also
troubled,
so self-destructive, and he would dance and then just sort of flop. And he'd bring rough trade back and get beaten up and all sorts of
really?
Stuff.
So he's sort of like manifested that, what do you call it, when you feel like you deserve it? What's that thing? It's like you make it happen.
It's the very
self-fulfilling prophecy type thing.
It's the old-fashioned sort of gay journey into misery. Yeah. But it was real. I mean, it's
tragic,
terribly sad. But as I tried to stress in the documentary, ultimately, it's not one long walk to the gallows. There's so much joy in his work.
Mm.
There really is. And that, you know, when he went to Corsica, and he's just like, the colours just blew his mind.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Imagine going there from austerity London.
Yeah.
And he's just like, wow.
And also he brought it back, didn't he, with him later. Yeah. So the later work, when he returns to London, you see that
more
impact.
More vibrant.
Definitely, yeah.
Well, I've got to say, this documentary you made is just phenomenal. So that everyone should watch this. It's not on iPlayer anymore. We found it on YouTube. The whole thing's been uploaded on YouTube.
Everything's fine now. It's all there. But as long as you can see it.
You created this documentary and you took it to the BBC and they said that no one knew him, so they weren't going to get behind it. And then so you funded it yourself.
Well, what happened was I'd been talking about, I originally approached the BBC about doing a drama, I mean, 20 years ago.
Would you have wanted to play him yourself?
No, it was that thing we were talking about. It's like this, he's like an amazing way into all these different lives. Mm-hmm. He's like the sort of
conduit.
He's like in I'm a Camera, you know, the Isherwood figure, just go, look, we follow Johnny and then look.
Yeah.
And it's, but it was, you know, they said, I'm ashamed, they actually said, I won't say it was, but said, I'm ashamed to say that I don't think even Bacon is a big enough figure these days.
Wow.
That was for, you know, arts.
So crazy.
And then over the years, I just thought, well, you know, these people aren't going to be here for much longer. And although we did discover a lot more people are around, because so many of his students were like 16 or 17, they're all cracking on, but there's a lot of them around, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. But I thought, I think I'm just going to have to do this. Mm. And I did talk to various broadcasters and they just said, I said, he's not really well known enough. And I thought, well, I'm just going to do it myself. And then very happily, blessedly, once we'd made about a third of it, we sort of cut together a trailer.
Taster. Oh,
and then the BBC said, yes.
So, oh, they did. Great.
Yeah. Cool. So they retrospectively, you know, commissioned it from
there. I think why it works so well is because you almost like step into his shoes and you go on the journey with him. Mm-hmm. So it's very much about your own, you know, experience too. And it was like your own journey.
It's what you're talking about. It's the passion thing. It's like I did my documentaries on horror movies and stuff like that. And I've resisted a lot of other things because I don't feel the same. And I could easily present things about and the reason I'm doing the Beardsley one is I also love Aubrey Beardsley, and I could do one about Goya or something. I could present it, but it doesn't mean the same. And I think you can communicate that passion and also that joy again if you're a real enthusiast.
Of course.
Then you've got a different. You're coming out from a different place, aren't you?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
I loved the painting that he made really early on where he's like reclining, kind of lying on the floor almost with that kind of, you know, landscape around him. And then at the end when you find that woman that met him on the street, and then that painting of him, you know, talking
picture.
About yeah, the
with
last
death
picture.
In the background.
Yeah,
like
with like
Grim Reaper
kind of
figure. It was an amazing moment, that, honestly. Because
you were really emotional.
Well, I honestly
didn't
know.
Did you see it on camera for the first time?
I didn't know it was coming.
Yeah, I didn't know if that, is that really, wow.
Yeah, and Matt Thomas, who's the producer director, who is he was also so utterly brilliant, but also he loves doing those kind of match shots. So if I go into a room and then we go from it just brings it all back
totally.
Together.
It's amazing.
But Louise Bain, who owned the Pink Show, was his student. Life is never that neat, and it really was.
Yeah.
He took her for a cup of coffee. She saw him on the King's Road. He took her a cup of coffee, and he tried to give her like £400. Which should have told her something. And she said, I don't want any money. And he said, stay there. And he came back half an hour later with this wet picture still wrapped in newspaper. And then 2 days later, she opened the paper and he died. But it's that, it's a statement, you know, and it is that, it's that figure again.
Yes, it's the same form, the male form, like lying down again. I know, yeah.
Naked, yeah. Do you think he was looking for someone to connect with just before he killed himself, and she just happened to be the one that...
I think so. I mean, you can never tell what's in people's minds, can you? And he tried a few times, and it might have been another...
Oh, he did make attempts.
It might have been another cry for help.
Always overdoses, were they all?
I think he tried to gas... Yes, he tried to gas himself with a gas poker, putting a bag over his head and a gas poker,
oh my God.
I remember. I think, but... You know, but then I remember talking to someone around the time whose brother-in-law had killed themselves, and... He said, well, you know, we intervened so many times, but we all knew one day we just won't be there.
Won't be there,
and
yeah.
that's why.
Right, right.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, yeah.
So, but I think he was on such a course, and felt, you know, there's a world in which the last pictures are these big history pictures, the death of Nelson and stuff like that, which I think are rather good, but people just didn't like them. And you can sense he's kind of going, I don't know what to do. And there could have been something like another Corsica, which just made him go, oh, it's this.
Yes.
And that might have... But he was up in Scotland like 2 days before he killed himself, working on a commission and stuff like that. But that's probably something to do with his condition.
Yeah.
You know, people just plunge, don't they?
Yeah.
And they can go from...
Yeah.
But if people say, I don't understand, he was the life and soul of the weekend.
Someone could be amazing at the party, laughing their head off, and then they go home and hang themselves.
And that's what, like, that's what...
And also, I think he was so deeply sensitive that he'd had this success and approval, and then he kind of lost that success in a way, because also the times were changing and the students were painting different kinds of paintings.
Oh, yes.
Inspired by, like, Jackson Pollock and that whole movement of art.
And he was against it.
And he was against it. And then, it's a really fascinating story. And then the idea that people like Bacon and Freud kind of weren't, you know, they had that competition between them. And then Bacon doing that amazing quote, which Russell loved.
This incredible quote. But he fell from grace, basically. He was the leader of the pack.
Yeah.
And suddenly his peers were like trailblazing beyond him. And they didn't sort of take him with them. They sort of disregarded him. And there's this amazing quote, which I didn't even realize was Bacon, where he poured champagne on John Minton's head in the Coach and Horses,
in the colony rooms, I think.
In the colony rooms, and said, "Champagne for my real friends, real pain for my sham friends." Basically calling John Minton a sham, which would have been an absolutely desperately sad for a man of his condition anyway to deal with that, with like such low self-esteem. But to hear that from someone who was your peer, to look down on you in that regard must have been...
Well, they're not generous. It's not a generous world. There's so much backbiting. And as I say about that quote about Freud, he sort of said he wasn't a painter. And they're really quite dismissive. And it's... I feel for him very much in those sort of situations, because you can project yourself into that sort of...
Oh, totally.
100%.
Yeah. I think particularly being gay and that whole journey he went on, you see the kind of longing in his early work and that kind of like, you know, aching for like something that he wasn't allowed to have, like something forbidden or something, and his obsession with sailors. Mm. And then by the end, the impact of the rejection. And that's such a theme that I've seen, you know, in the gay community even now, is this idea of rejection, either from your family or from society or when you're growing up, you know, you might know that you're different, and then that sense of rejection can just be devastating.
But you're also, you're comparing yourself constantly.
Yeah.
Compare
to body types or facial or whatever, or you feel like you're, you know, getting left behind by everything and you're desperate. I mean, it's the oldest story in the world, isn't it? But it depends how you wrestle with it, how you cope with it. And the people who survive either, I think, become content or they outstrip it by becoming impregnable, like Bacon. You know, Bacon was such a nasty little queen.
Yeah.
But a brilliant painter and a brilliant worker. Mm. I mean, with his own extraordinary trouble. You know, but when his lover, George, killed himself in
George
Paris.
George Dyer,
And Bacon kept the news back for 24 hours in order to stop it spoiling his opening.
There's
a certain level of
it's just unbelievable.
Troll.
And also, even Freud, like, he painted every single day. You know, it's all about the painting.
Yeah.
And it becomes the priority. But also, that's interesting because both those artists have become incredibly well-known, regardless of what that BBC person thought. But their work is so much more, in a way, psychological and kind of has a... Like, you were talking about that portrait of by Freud of Minton. Like, they just have this kind of interior, you know, personality and characteristics within it. And then Bacon took it even more, you know, almost like strips the flesh off it and gets down to... Yeah. I always remember that painting of the tap with, like, it's almost like a body pouring through a tap or something. Yes. You know, he sort of gets to the root of human existence and pain and sadness and sexuality and all these things. But I always felt a bit like John Minton's were slightly more surface. It's almost like...
They are, yes.
But they're still great, but it's almost like he wanted to be loved or something too much.
I think there's
that need for a love.
There's a pop-art vibe to it.
Yeah. And also the illustration,
haunts
his painting, because he was a master illustrator.
And they're amazing. The books he did are like works of art themselves. They're incredible. Beautiful.
But it's not...
Wasn't good enough for him.
Wasn't enough for him, and I think it wasn't enough for the art establishment, because he wanted to prove himself as a painter. I think. I mean, I've got one of his oils, and
where did you get it from?
From an auction.
Did you? How much did you pay for it? Can we ask?
£5.
No.
No.
No. Oh. £5 plus some more money.
£5 and change.
And this arm and this leg.
But it was worth it. That for you
was
like...
It was entirely. It brings me daily joy.
And what is it of?
It's fascinating. It's labelled Portraits of Michael. And I couldn't find who it was. And then I showed it to Norman Bowler. And he said, oh, that's Josh Avery. And I knew about Josh Avery. But he said, "Oh, you like to be called Mike." And that, it's one of those amazing things. I mean, Norman you might be the only person left.
You'd, if you'd never met him, you'd
he would
never
just be portrait of unknown Michael.
Is it more? Is it a very crutchy sort of?
No, no. It's Head and Shoulders. It's a lovely picture. I'll show you in a minute. But yeah. There is a lot to be said for those criticisms. They lack psychological depth. There's his obsession with the male form and the centre of gravity.
Yeah.
In those, which he did in those wonderful Windsor chair pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've got, I love them. They're monumental, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I wonder if he'd lived, whether he might have gone somewhere much more interesting in that way. I mean, you know, Bacon and Freud were gifted painters, but they were also very lucky.
But they went out of fashion. So if you look at the arc of art history, the fact that at some point no one cared about him. So for John Minton, that might have been his low at that point. But he might have sprung up and become even more famous.
And also, I think someone like Freud and Bacon, their some of their later work is like so incredible.
Yeah.
So actually, Bacon, I think Bacon less so actually, but the Freud particularly, you know, the last, say, 10 years of his life.
Oh, yes.
I mean, monumental, incredible paintings. So you're right. I mean, Minton was so talented that maybe he would have.
But it's we'll never know, but it's, you know, or he might have just gone into illustration and just totally mastered that and become, I mean, that's what he's most famous for, if he's famous at all. I was very keen, I started off the documentary by saying, you may not have heard of John Minton, because I didn't want to presume, because I thought if I was watching this, I'd go, yes, I fuck it. But I was amazed to discover how few people had, and I was very touched by the amount of the responses I got. To that.
You introduced people to his work you said he was forgotten and he had been forgotten and you did bring...
I wasn't really aware of him at all. I only knew him as a name, actually. So it was fascinating documentary for me because I learned so much from it. And I had no idea he was connected to all those people and all of that is an incredible...
He's not a fundamental point in art history. He is part of a collection of a moment, isn't he?
But I think it's, you know, what I've responded to all those years ago and still do is that I find his pictures beautiful and sad and also I love that mid-century palette of the sort of there's a sort of metallic blues and there's wonderful pictures of Rotherhithe and the docks and
you called him an urban romantic
There's a rustiness to them and it's very post-war. It's still sort of, but it's sort of optimistic, you know, for a while at any rate.
Yeah.
There's a sort of newness about things. The wonderful travel posters and stuff like that. And I love all that kind of, it's like, right, the war is over. We're moving forward.
I love post-war architecture, like Brutus architecture. Yeah, yeah. For me, always feels so hopeful and proud and futuristic and looking forward.
But as you talk, you know, the arc of history, it's like it was absolutely irredeemably despised and now people genuinely love it. Yeah. And when
people still hate the National Theatre and Barbican, my God.
But I love it.
I love them.
I can't get enough
Although
of it.
Although, actually, I had to grow to love them. In my 20s, I really didn't get it.
No, I agree. Absolutely.
And then in my 30s, I got it. It's really funny. It's like it was like I had to mature in order to
accept and understand it. Matured as well in the time that it became less brutal. Yeah. You know, it became more acceptable to the eye. Yeah.
You know, something that I really like about the documentary is that it's kind of like, which we've been talking a lot about. We just interviewed an artist who passed away and we did her last interview. And there's this kind of idea of somehow recording people's voices and field recording, but also, you know, documenting histories that are important to maybe smaller groups of people, but that might be out of fashion at the moment, but in, you know, are really important to document.
A testament.
And that's what, and that's what I thought was really great about the show, but also in what you've been doing in some of your shows that you've been commissioning and writing, like Queers that you did for BBC4 that you were in.
Yep.
Yeah, can you talk a bit about that? Do you find this idea of like social change as an important thread in what you do now? Or is it something that's becoming more so?
Well, that was one of those things. What I get, you know, I get emails saying sometimes, you know, would you be interested in this? And I'll tell you one later, which always makes me laugh, where someone was like, they wouldn't tell me what it was about. They were so convinced it was like the opportunity of a lifetime. I just kept saying, but what is it? Ah, well, I'll tell you. But sometimes something happens. And BBC4 just approached me saying, we'd like you to do some monologues for the 50th anniversary of partial decriminalisation. And I just went, I literally, there's nothing I'd rather do. It was, the whole thing was so exciting.
Mm.
And the idea, first of all, of commemorating it, and then monologues, which I absolutely adore as a form. Alan Bennett's such a huge influence on me and everything I've done. And, you know, celebrating and investigating gay life over a century, But and then also getting new writers in, which there are so few opportunities in television these days just to get a new voice. It's like, this is a gold mine, you know. But, you know, a huge part of it was that was testimony, you know, and all of the stories really, to a greater or lesser extent, based on some sort of real experience. And I was really trying to come at it as a curator in a different way. So I remember going to London when I first moved here, and I went to what I thought was a very sophisticated gay party. I'm sure it wasn't. But there was this wonderful old guy there who, he's like a Polari speaker. He was proper. And I remember, this is all I remember, two things I remember about the party was, what, I didn't get off with anyone. Disaster. The three things. Secondly, that around about midnight, I thought, if I don't get out of here now, I think they might eat me, you know. And thirdly, that this old guy said, it's never the same, you know, dear, never the same. And it's always stuck with me. And he meant after 67, it wasn't as good. And I'd never forgotten that. And you read a lot of testimony of people who missed the war. That's what it's called, I Missed
of
the
course.
War.
Of course, yeah.
Because of the risk and the...
And this is a fundamental thing. I think it throbs at the heart of the gay experience now and forever, is the victories you achieve towards being accepted also mean that you lose your outsider status, and your outsider status is also an enormous part of who you are.
Yeah.
And that tension, I think, is fascinating. And it exhibits itself in different ways. So, you know, it's amazing. We can get married, kind of totally equal rights. We can have children, adopt children, have children, whatever. But there's also people going, but I don't want that.
I don't want to be gentrified.
I don't want to be
homogenized. They miss the criminalisation. Yeah. They miss the secret furtive world where it's a handshake and a wink. And Polari, can you just speak about Polari a bit for people who don't know what that is?
I wish I could speak it.
Can you
speak it? No. It's
I would love to do a course on Polari.
I wonder if there's a light school.
There must be, yeah.
Polari is a thieves' cant, as Matthew Baldwin, who wrote that monologue, says. It's a strange language which grew up in the turn of the century, really, some sort of combination of Romany and often just reversing words, you know. So Varda, that dolly oleek, which means, you know, look at that beautiful face, and lallies for legs, and it was a survival mechanism, you know. And people had a secret code they could communicate with, and
so if you watch amazing
the Naked Civil Servant, it's all those sort of coffee bars and places which were raided. And but it was an amazing community. And, you know, there are still people around who, like Bette Bourne, who can speak it.
Yeah.
And it is like a lost language. It's like a dying language.
Yeah.
You know, I was just reading the new book, Mr. Know-It-All by John Waters, and it's just come out on Little Brown, I think, the publisher. And there's a whole chapter in there where he talks about how disappointed he is, in a way, in becoming respectable.
Yeah.
And this idea that, like, his films are now being shown at MoMA, and when he made them, the soundtracks to them were totally, like, legal, and you would never get permission for him to broadcast them. Mm. And now he's got them all signed off. And, now he has people queuing for him to do a talk, or now everyone's
That's
reading his books, and that he's somehow having to deal with
That's
this idea that he's no longer an outsider.
That was whole Quentin Crisp's thing, wasn't
totally,
it? He hated
yeah.
the fact that homosexuality was becoming... Okay, accepted.
Yes.
And I mean, the what John Waters should do now is go to MoMA and do a big shit on the stage and eat it.
Yeah,
that would do it.
Oh my god,
that'd be like a full circle, wouldn't it?
He's in their permanent collection. They'd love to have that one.
But that's what Tony Benn talked about, you know, in his last years, when he used to do these lecture tours, and you know, 90% of his audience were Daily Mail readers, the people who literally once thought he was practically the Antichrist, and it had him poisoned. And he said that the journey, the dangerous thing is you become venerable, and then you're totally defanged. And I suppose that's a journey of every artist like that. The journey towards becoming Sir Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
Is you think. And the people who've not done that.
I know, but David Bowie said no for that reason.
Exactly.
Because he said that he didn't. I just looked into it. My mum just got an MBE, and I was looking in. The first thing I did was actually look at all the people who have turned it down.
Yeah.
And the reasons are really brilliant.
Yeah.
But his was great, because he's like, I did not do all of this to become David Bowie CBE.
Yeah.
Like, because that somehow then puts you in a different.
Absolutely. And he's doing, I mean.
Whereas my mum's thing's for charity,
it neutralises your campaign.
Yeah, and it kind of makes you something else.
It makes you totally establishment.
It does, and about Britain and Great Britain rather than...
The British Empire.
Exactly, yeah, the Empire.
And now we have Sir Ian Duncan Smith. I mean, if this whole thing wasn't ever totally devalued, it certainly is now. But it's, you know, Bowie was like an artist to his death and beyond. But, you know, that's, it's an incredible career. Mm.
And also, he wasn't, I don't think he could limit him to one place either.
No.
He was so much beyond like a country or the boundary of a place.
It's the real thing. Yeah. And I think that last album, actually, my favourite is the one before, that song, Where Are We Now?
Yeah, amazing.
Which just came out of nowhere. It makes me cry. It's so beautiful. But everything he does in that last stage, and then he did, you know, he did that Broadway thing.
Yeah, the Ivar Van Hove
didn't really work, but he was like, he was trying. And then about a year after he died, someone noticed that the black star, if you leave it out in the light, it changes colour. So there's...
What do you mean, on the album?
On the album.
On the album sleeve,
It sort of changes to a sort of rainbow.
Yeah, the ink
changes. Like, there's one last thing. It's so like a sort of Easter egg. You know, you think, God, he's doing it from beyond the grave.
You know what else I really loved that he did? One of his last interviews, he spoke all about like the next generation and Kendrick Lamar, and sort of almost like passed the baton to him and was talking about how progressive and futuristic, you know, Kendrick was. And I think that was such a generous thing to do at the end of your life, to kind of talk about somebody else rather than your own legacy or something.
Yeah, amazing. Tell us about the guy who tried to commission you to do something but kept it all secretive and furtive and wouldn't tell you what the thing
was. Oh, no, I have to do that secretly.
Oh, I thought that was right. Oh, okay. That's not for public knowledge.
It's really funny, though.
What is this next show you're creating, then, that you're producing?
Aubrey Beardsley.
Yes.
Tell us about Aubrey Beardsley. Beardsley is an amazing figure. Another part of another circle, this time essentially Oscar Wilde's circle. And he was a supernaturally gifted artist who, from the age of 7, basically was condemned to death by TB.
Wow.
And he's a very delicate boy. He looks like a stick with a centre party. And he sort of dabbled, and then his great hero was an artist called Edward Burne-Jones, and he went to meet him. Burne-Jones was incredibly kind and supportive and helpful. And then Beardsley just does it. I mean, it's almost impossible to believe. You look at his work, and it's like if he'd lived till he was 80, you go, oh, that's the middle period. And his middle period is about 6 months in 1893. He changes style so quickly and with such skill, it's almost unbelievable, and mostly from his sickbed.
And so what was his work like before this time?
Well, he's very influenced by Burne-Jones, sort of pencil drawings. They're very
figurative,
willowy figures.
Yes.
And then he got this commission to illustrate Maud d'Arthur, The Death of Arthur, and he does it in this very William Morris, Burne-Jones style. And it's like it changes his life. But very quickly, he gets bored and starts to experiment and starts smuggling in these very strange, grotesque figures. He's obsessed with fetuses, and they get odder and odder. And then he illustrates Wilde's play, Salome, which changes everything.
Mm.
And then he becomes the art editor of the Yellow Book, which is the principal, you know, text of the fantasy arc. And then it just explodes, and it becomes the Beardsley period. And he literally is it. He's 1895, that's what he is. And then Wilde falls, and he's sort of pulled down in the fallout.
Wow.
And he dies at 25, having done more work in about 4 or 5 years than most people achieve in their entire life. It's an extraordinary
story. And recognised by the RA at the time, or...?
No, he was very... I mean, he was... He's,
outsider.
He's a real outsider. But he's a same sort of strange thing. He's a sort of outsider who wants to get in. Once he's in, he wants to get out.
Yeah.
And he's constantly pulling against it. He can't... He's a self-saboteur. His last letter... His final publisher was an amazing man called Leonard Smithers, who is one of the most wonderfully disreputable figures you'll ever... A charming man, incredibly kind, and very sleazy. He's sort of pornographer.
Mm.
But in the end, he was the only person who would publish Beardsley because his reputation had sort of dive-bombed post-Wild. But he would sort of mortgage his house to help his artists. But from his deathbed in Menton, where I'm going next week, in the south of France, he wrote this letter, I implore you, destroy all obscene drawings in my death agony, A.B.
Wow.
And Smithers, of course, didn't. he sold them and then eventually dealt in fakes and stuff like that. But his great infamy lies, and he did a series of illustrations for Lysistrata, the Aristophanes.
Why couldn't he destroy his own drawings?
Oh, well, Smithers had them in London. He was in France.
I see.
And he did this play called Lysistrata, a famous play, which we should do now, not just the play, but the actual idea, because all the women of Athens go on a sex strike until their men stop fighting. It's a great idea.
I've heard about that.
We should all go on a sex strike. Yes. I'm trying. And, but as in the play, they all have enormous phalluses. I mean, like they're literally brushing against people's noses like that. They're extraordinarily rude pictures, but they're beautiful. You see, they're absolutely beautiful things. And he's a strange mixture. The delicacy of his line, it's like nobody else. His use of black and white, his use of negative space. He is hugely influential.
I know, and I think he really inspired the kind of 60s, like hippie movement, and you know the graphic design that was related to all of that.
He had this second life again.
Yeah,
he was it. He died in 1895, and that was it, consigned to history. In 1966, the V&A had a massive retrospective, and it changed the face of cool Britannia, as it were. It's a huge part of what made the 60s swing is Aubrey Beardsley.
Totally.
People went nuts for it. And everywhere, there are Athena
but
posters.
Like Peter Blake sort of like?
Well, just all, not just the influence on the arts at the time, but just people, literally posters. Posters on everyone's wall. There's a famous one from Salome called The Peacock Skirt. And the whole Bieber thing is basically Beardsley.
Yeah.
Everything became Art Nouveau because of that exhibition. It's one of those incredible instances where you just go, everything changed because of that exhibition.
I always think of Beardsley, I think they're slightly different times, maybe not though, with Erte as well.
Yes,
Erte?
Yes, yeah.
Because that's similar. I think they were born at a similar time. Erte was like a Russian-French artist who was kind of more like well-known in the 20s.
There's Mucha is another. There's a lot of influences around, swilling around the same time, which become sort of Art Nouveau. But Beardsley is he's the master, and it's just that it's fascinating that, as you say, that thing of like a second act, you know, not forgotten because people took the baton, and in terms of like magazine illustration, they always knew he was the man. But then
the inner circles, they knew of him.
Yeah, and but then the influence on pop culture in the mid-60s is incredible. It's you can't really think
of
it.
Do you think there's anything comparable in our lifetime that shows that have had that sort of effect on the world?
Balamori.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose everyone, there's about to be another Beardsley retrospective.
Is there? So we'll see what happens.
And I suppose every curator dreams that their show is the one. But it does happen. You kind of, not just those blockbuster shows, but it's amazing how, I went to the one last year at the RA where they'd put together as much as they could of Charles I's art collection, which was you know, sold off by Cromwell.
When his head was cut off.
Yeah. And, you know, they're incredible pictures because he bought someone else's collection. That was the sort of locus of his collection. And it was astonishing then and it's astonishing now. But the most moving thing was that some of these pictures were on the same walls for the first time in 370 years.
Wow. Where was that?
The Royal Academy. And that I found that terribly moving somehow. I mean, Charles I is a monster. Fascinating man. Someone said a bad king with great taste.
Yes.
But I found that strangely moving. It's like these pictures have not shared a wall. Sometimes they're pairs, you know, and they've been split.
You were saying that about Minton, that a lot of the works would only have lived in that world in his studio, and then they get sent off around the world to collections wherever, and they're never seen again. And sometimes when you bring works back together, like we did David Dawson recently for the Lucian Freud portrait show, self-portrait show,
yeah.
A lot of them works would never have been in the same room with each other for the past,
and some of them have not even been shown in public.
Some of them are series. Well, you know. Do you know what I mean? They're like triptychs or whatever.
Well, you get obviously they disappear into collections.
Yeah,
and also there's a thing I didn't know about until recently. Where there's an actual lending limit. Excuse me. So some of the Beardsleys, some of the most famous Beardsleys, will not be in this exhibition because they've been lent three times in the last 5 years, and there's a limit. because they're delicate and stuff.
Yeah, because like works and, on paper particularly, you have to really
that,
protect.
Like Da Vinci as well, like the one that's coming up at the Louvre is going to be the last one, isn't it?
Yes, they won't see it.
In our lifetime,
And that's, I mean, there's something really brilliant about that as well. Yes. Got to
I know, they need to go back into the dark drawer.
Yeah.
It's like the Queen's collection. She has loads of amazing drawings.
Da Vinci drawings.
Yeah, and they can only come out like once every
You know that wonderful thing that... That project, which Dr. Bender Grosvenor, you should have one, who's an amazing man. He does
Bender.
Bender, yeah.
Oh, Bendor, okay.
Bendor.
Yep.
He does Britain's Lost Masterpieces. Mm-hmm. And they're digitizing the collection, the storage collections of all these, basically everything that's in storage around in museums and stuff, because they want to get them shown. And also, he's got an amazing, he found a Van Dyke, and they're just there, or they've been painted over, or they're slightly disguised, and he found this, re-identified this portrait of Bond Prince Charlie and stuff like that. It's amazing, but unless they're out there, they're literally just going to stay in dark rooms forever.
Vaults, yeah.
And, you know, most museums sort of display 2% of their collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's only when they're sort of rotated or someone does a retrospective. And some of these very, very good and very famous pictures are literally never seen.
Mm. I'm trying to think back from shows that have been massive influences, and there's two that spring to mind. The British show, which was what Saatchi put on, that so many artists of the YBA generation were inspired by is when he brought over a collection of American artists. Mm. So for the first time, a lot of people were seeing Ellsworth Kelly's, or they were seeing Barnett Newman's, or they were seeing who else was they seeing? Like Boundary Road at the
Suffolk. Jeff Koons,
and stuff like that. And also the Sensation Show, which was the YBA show, which was a huge, which definitely did change popular culture. Mm. Everything about that. So many people talked about the shark in formaldehyde, the bloodhead by Mark Quinn, Marcus Harvey's Myra Hindley with the kids' hands, Tracy Emin's bed, Sarah Lucas's, Ron Muick's dad. All
I don't
of
think
these
Tracy's
things.
Bed was in that. I think her tent was in it.
But it's that sort of thing, isn't it? You're absolutely right. It's like it dominates the conversation, good and bad. It becomes an easy joke to talk about modern art in that way.
Yeah.
But you only do that if you've actually had that influence.
Yes.
And sometimes that really does happen.
It became the zeitgeist. You know? And I'm thinking of one in America was an artist called Kerry James Marshall, and he had a big show at the Met. And I think that changed culture within the art world.
It's one of the greatest exhibitions I've ever seen in my life.
I think for so many young artists went to see that show and were just so blown away by it.
That's what I love, that. And you can trace that with all your favourite artists, you know, that they famously go to the Picasso exhibition, and it just changes the history of art.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's direct imitation, other times it's just like, oh, I see what you're...
Oh, that brushstroke, that's it, that's what I've been looking for.
Or that sort of, or just an attitude, you know. Yeah. There's Sorolla is one of my favourite painters, a Spanish, but he's just astonishing. He's the master of light. And there was a wonderful exhibition of his last year at the Royal Academy, and it was one of those, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a Monet, it wasn't a blockbuster.
Mm.
But I went twice, and just walking around it, people were just gaping at it. It's like, Christ, these are good. Mm. And put them all together, you get this impression. There's one, it's just of a matchbox factory or something like that in Spain. And there's just a block of sunlight coming through the window. And I just went up as close as I was allowed. I was going, how have you done that? It actually looks like light. It doesn't even look like a colour.
Mm.
It defies analysis. You just go, Jesus, this man is an absolute master. Mm. It's so extraordinary. And I love that. Yeah, I love that you don't just sort of traipse around just sort of ticking the boxes or going, oh, it's that famous picture or something. But you can have that. If you find yourself in the gallery, sometimes you do stumble across a really famous picture. And it's like sort of standing next to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. You go, is this really it?
The actual one, or is this,
But they're always smaller than you think.
But then it can also have that power. You sort of go, well, I can see what it is. Van Gogh's like that, I think. You know, he's become so jigsaw. When you actually stand in front of one of his pictures,
the ones at the National Gallery in London.
Yeah.
That was the first thing that came into my head when you started talking about that. Mm. When I saw, I think, the sunflowers, or you see certain like haystacks or these paintings, they are completely incredible in real life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they are smaller as well, because in your head they become these giant...
Or you get that gentrified, don't they, when they get reproduced?
Yeah. Well, you see them everywhere. They're on like a coaster or they're on...
But there's also so much to discover.
We've got two questions.
Two questions to ask you. One, what would be your art heist? If you could steal any artwork in the world and live with it, your touchstone artwork, what would it be?
Actually, funnily enough, I think it might... There's a Monet of Haystacks in the Snow. Mm. And I've forgotten where that is now. But, you know, those... he did hundreds of those. And that, you know... But I love snowy pictures. I love snowy landscapes. Weirdly, it's that. I think I've seen... I've sat in front of that picture a lot.
You don't know where, though?
I can't remember where. It might be New York.
Yeah, probably somewhere. All knowing you. And so the second glamorous. Question
and the second question we ask is, what is your favourite colour?
Oh, orange.
Oh, that's
my favourite colour. Yeah.
Why, Mark? Because your hair?
Why, Mark?
Grey.
Grey orange.
No, I love it. It's
You're a redhead, aren't you?
I used to be. What's left of it?
No, you're still redhead.
I ginger beard, collars and cuffs.
Yes.
I love its optimism, and I love burnt orange particularly. But I love it. It's great. I love its earthiness. It's a sort of Roman colour. We used to in our old house. We used to have the kitchen wall was very, very strong orange, and you think you can't get away with that. And it was like everyone would, it was a place you'd be drawn to it by its like, this is lovely, sort of terracotta-y thing. Mm. I love it. I love orange.
Burnt orange makes me think of like West Berlin post war, like that sort of lava ware.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of imagine that colour.
And upholstery.
Upholstery. Yes, sort of. Yes, I've got burnt orange. I've got orange.
Grand Budapest Hotel in the 60s version. That sort of, I love that. Yeah.
That kind of Hessian fabric, isn't it? Yeah. Well, you've got to rush off. To where are you going to?
Go to Sheffield to see Guys and Dolls with Kadeef.
Ah, yes.
Oh, yeah, and Kadeef was in Queers,
that's
wasn't he?
Right,
yeah, yes. He's a great actor, Kadeef Cohen. We just had New Year with him.
Yes. Did you?
It was very fun. Yeah, he came down to London. It was really fun.
Meant to be.
We love you, Kadeef. He's great.
And
thank
we love you,
so much. It's been such a great privilege to hear you speak.
Yes.
And we will be back very soon. We're going to be posting images of all the artworks we've spoken about in today's show on our Instagram at Talk Art. Are you on Instagram?
No.
No.
You should start on Instagram with your artworks.
Maybe I will.
Okay.
Good times.
All right, well, big love, everyone. Thank you so much for listening.
We'll be back very soon.
Coming on, Mark. Cheers.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.